This is the last day of this April 2011 seven-day session. And we'll read comment on another koan. This is in the Shoyo Roku, the Book of Serenity, and number 46. And it's called Deshan's Study Accomplished. Great Master Yuan Ming of Deshan addressed his assembly, saying, Extinguish every conceptual thought, and all the Buddhas in the three worlds will be unable to open their mouths. But there is a person who will give a great laugh. If you recognize that person, you've completed your practice. Now this Deshan whose Japanized name is Toksan is not the very famous one who came to enlightenment when the master blew out the candle, the one who encountered the old woman on the road who challenged him about the Diamond Sutra. This is actually, interestingly enough, this Deshan is the great grandson in the Dharma to that Deshan. We have a little information about him. He lived in the 10th century. He was a disciple of the great Yunmen, or Ummon. I'm reading here from Zen's Chinese Heritage, translated by Andy Ferguson. He says that almost nothing is recorded of this teacher's personal life. Of all of Yunmen's disciples, it was this Deshan who developed the largest group of followers. Just a couple, three dialogues here. A monk asked, "What is it before the 100 flowers bloom?" Of course, we know what he's asking about. What is it before the 100 flowers bloom? And Deshan said, "The yellow river's turbid flow." The monk asked, "What about after they bloom?" Deshan said, "The top of the flagpole points toward the sky." Another time, Deshan entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, "You must study living phrases. Do not study dead phrases. Enlightenment that is realized through living phrases is never lost." And then he lists what he calls three dead phrases. A single mote of dust, a Buddha world. That's one. A single leaf, a Shakyamuni. Yeah, there are just two of them. So those are, he says, these are dead phrases. And then, three more. With a raised eyebrow and the twinkling of an eye, lifting a single finger and establishing Buddha. These are also dead phrases. And then he gives two more. The mountains, rivers, and the great earth. And never again making errors. These are also dead phrases. So some of these are familiar to me, so they must have been widely used and familiar at the time, which is just his point. It's like, as with cliches, things are used too much, then they lose their power to move us. A monk then asked, "What are living phrases?" Deshan answered, "A Persian looks up to see it." Persian here would refer to Bodhidharma, probably. Though he was from southern India, there are those historians who think it may have been Persia. The monk said, "If it is as you say, then we won't make a mistake." Deshan hit the monk. You know, this striking of monks by masters, it should be understood, that the context of this should be understood, that I've been told that in China and Japan, being struck by one's master is seen as a real affirmation. It's appreciated. I suppose it's a bit like a couple of teenage boys who might, good friends who might sort of sock one on the shoulder when you see each other. It's not quite the same, but it's appreciated in the same way. It's as appreciated as being. It's hard. It's hard to articulate it, but it does not have the punitive quality that we might give it. A monk asked, "What is the style of the master's house?" What that really means is, what is the style of your training, your Zen? Deshan said, "The clouds rise on South Mountain, the rain falls on North Mountain." A monk asked, "How was it before Nu Dao met the fourth ancestor?" Nu Dao must have been a master, probably the Dharma heir of the fourth ancestor, went on to become him. So how was it before he met the fourth ancestor? Of course, that would imply came to awakening under the fourth ancestor. Deshan said, "In the fall, yellow leaves fall." A monk asked, "How was it after he met him?" Deshan said, "In the spring, the grass is itself green." That's all the information we have on this relatively unknown master. So now let's go into the back to the case. Great Master Yuan Ming of Deshan. Deshan would have been the mountain where his monastery was. Very, very often these masters would just take the name of the mountain they lived on. That's a real expression of no self. Just, all right. And he said, "Extinguish every conceptual thought, and all the Buddhas in the three worlds will be unable to open their mouths." This phrase, "extinguish every conceptual thought," it's not an uncommon one in Zen texts as a translation. It can be misleading. It suggests that we are trying to get rid of thoughts, which is the fatal error to think that we're going to get rid of them or stop them or such things. It's this practice is not a matter of doing something in that sense. It is at heart a practice of non-doing, allowing the thoughts to settle. We don't have to extinguish them, strictly speaking. There's nothing to them. There's nothing to them. They have no roots, these thoughts. They arise, they last a shorter or longer period of time in the mind, and they fade away and disappear if we leave them alone. All that happens with great quickness if we don't get involved with them. A better word might be detach from every conceptual thought. Don't have anything to do with any thought. What's so hard about this is that thoughts don't just mean discrete, particular thoughts, like the thought of where I'm going to sleep tonight after Sashin, the thought of what the weather will be like tomorrow. Those are discrete, particular thoughts. Those aren't really such a big deal. We learn eventually, and that's the word, we learn that if we just leave those things alone, we notice them, go back to the practice, if we can do that, that they just don't last. They're just nothing. They don't amount to anything. But those are the ones we notice. The real problem are the thoughts we don't notice. And here, I want to draw from Roshi Kaplow's distinction between thinking and thoughting. Thinking, he used to emphasize, is something that we need to do often. Some of us need to do it often. It's like one type of thinking is solving a problem. Zen has no quarrel with that. Using the mind in a very specific, incisive way is to solve a problem. Do something, plan something logistic, or make some kind of a simple decision. The real problem is what Roshi Kaplow called thoughting, which is completely random kind of activity in the mind that has no focus to it, no direction. It's just thoughts buzzing in the mind. And when we get used to thoughts buzzing in the mind, when we've been doing it for years, if not decades, then we become unaware of it. It's like radio static. When a radio is set between channels, it's as though when we come to practice, this radio has been running on static for years. And it's just been it's become the normal part of our awareness, background static. But because it's just become the norm, we don't notice it. We don't notice how much noise there is in the mind until we get to experience some moments where the static stops. And that's the great, great value of Zazen, but especially Sesshin, because in Sesshin we have our best chance of hearing a little bit, little breaks in that statics. And when once we've heard a break, then we know that there's something else, something beyond the static. So the real problem, the real challenge in our practice is this thoughting, or we could say even a kind of a film of thoughts, a film of thoughting that's going on all the time in the mind that we don't even notice. Now that's a problem if we don't even see it. But through practice, we come to realize after the fact that that's what was going on. Then, now, we've got something other than the static. That is what proves that there is something beyond this, the activity of this conceptual, discursive intellect. There's a famous passage in the Dhammapada, very well-known text attributed to the Buddha, where he talks about thoughts like as follows. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If one speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him, as the wheel follows the foot of the ox that draws the carriage. And then, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If one speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him, like a shadow that never leaves him. Well, in Zen, we would certainly not dispute what he's saying, but in Zen, and this isn't Zen, the Zen school, in Zen, we're not trying to cultivate pure thoughts. We want to see through all thoughts and into the source of all thoughts. Not to replace evil thoughts with pure thoughts, because thoughts divide our experience of the world. Even pure thoughts, if we superimpose them on direct experience, then there's something extra. There's a lot better than evil thoughts, but even better still, it's no thought. Extinguish every conceptual thought. We can't do it directly. We can't get in with a hammer and wrench and somehow pry these thoughts out. And so we have the practice. We have the breath, the koan, and so forth. As a way of detaching from every kind of thought, even the most exalted thoughts. and images. In other traditions, you meditate on images, you visualize certain Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and other kinds of Buddhism. You may practice loving kindness meditation, where you set about to generate thoughts of loving kindness. These are great, wonderful practices. It's just they're not Zen in the purest sense. There are those who are attracted to those practices and for whom those practices work, and that's wonderful. And then there are others of us who just want to empty the mind. Or through this our particular practice, experience the fundamental emptiness of the mind. And it is fundamental. There's a passage that always spoke to me by a Zen teacher by the name of Takashina. I don't know anything about him, but these are nice words. He says, "The true basis of the universe is stillness, its real condition, for out of it comes all activity. The ocean, when the wind ceases, is calm again, as are the trees and grasses. These things return to stillness, their natural way. And this is the principle of Zazen. There is night, there is day. When the sun sets, there is a hush. And then the dead of night, when all is still. This is the meditation of nature." So it's not a matter of manufacturing silence. It's just a matter of allowing the mind to return to its original state. The silence that really goes beyond ordinary silence, the silence that stands in opposition to sound. In sound, too, we can find silence. Every person surely has the experience, at least fleetingly in Sesshin, of hearing the call of the bird, the song, as never before. Because the static is quiet, has stopped. Linchi Rinzai once said, "Learn to cut off successive thoughts, and this is worth more than 10 years of pilgrimage." The word, the Japanese word is nen, which is exceedingly difficult to translate, to find an English equivalent for it. It's sort of a thought moment. This is the word in the Kanon Sutra that we chant, that we render as moment. This moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mind. Well, that would be in the Japanese version of the chant. It's nen. Learn to cut off successive nen. Learn to not attach to thoughts as they arise. He says successive nen. That's That's what follows the direct experience. So we hear the bird song. That's the direct experience. That's what they call the first Nen. Just the pure, simple, direct experience, sense experience, hearing the bird song. But what so often happens is after that, like a millionth of a billionth of a second later, there is some second thought-like thing that happens. And then maybe after that, a third one. And then you're off and running. Then you've exited the throughway. And you're off in the woods, off in the weeds. So to notice, to catch the mind before it heads out like that, this is what it's all about. This is extinguishing every conceptual thought. Extinguish every conceptual thought, and all the Buddhas in the three worlds will be unable to open their mouths. What does this mean? In the realm of no thought, of utter purity, the mind undivided, there are no Buddhas. There are no unenlightened ones. There are no demons. There are no angels. There's just no us and them. There's no self and other. There's no right and wrong, no good and bad, no higher and lower, no before and after. Favorite passages about silence is one I've read several times in Taisho. Those of you who have heard it more than once, you can try to hear it for the first time, and I'll try to read it for the first time. This is from an Edgar Lee Masters, whose dates are 1869 to 1950. I have known the silence of the stars and of the sea, and the silence of the city when it pauses, and the silence of a man and a maid, and the silence for which music alone finds the word, and the silence of the woods before the winds of spring begin, and the silence of the sick when their eyes roam about the room. And I ask for the depths of what use is language. A beast of the field moans a few times when death takes its young. And we are voiceless in the presence of realities we cannot speak. A curious boy asks an old soldier sitting in front of the grocery store, "How did you lose your leg?" and the soldier is struck with silence. Or his mind flies away because he cannot concentrate it on Gettysburg. It comes back jocosely, and he says, "A bear bit it off." There is the silence of a great hatred and the silence of a great love and the silence of a deep peace of mind and the silence of an embittered friendship. There's the silence of a spiritual crisis through which your soul, exquisitely tortured, comes with visions not to be uttered into a realm of higher life. There's the silence of those unjustly punished, and the silence of the dying whose hand suddenly grips yours. There's the silence of those who have failed, and the vast silence that covers broken nations and vanquished leaders. And there is the silence of age, too full of wisdom for the tongue to utter it in words intelligible to those who have not lived the great range of life. Herman Melville said, silence is the only voice of our God. And then Deshan continues, after he says, "And all the Buddhas in the three worlds will be unable to open their mouths, but there is a person who will give a great laugh." If you recognize that person, you've completed your practice. Who is this one who will give a great laugh? If you recognize that person, you've completed your practice. There's a fable in Zen about Bodhidharma sitting facing the wall of this cave for 9 years and some boys encountering him sitting there like a stone Buddha facing the wall, and them never having seen such a thing, talking about it, getting more and more curious and puzzled, and finally, as little boys are wont to do, they finally just, out of complete bafflement, one of them throws a stone. They're still keeping their distance, but he throws a stone, hits Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma turns with a great roar, having just come to enlightenment. A roar of laughter. Out of an empty mind suddenly bursts this delight with the world, phenomena. Just phenomena. I think of the laughter, the smiles of infants. We will never know what prompts that laughter. That's the smiling. Maybe it's the same basic thing. Nothing in the mind, and suddenly mother or father is cooing and making faces and coochie coochie coo. Just things, the world as it is. Bah, look at that. Ha! 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 Out of nothing, everything. Fresh, new, astonishing. There are those who misunderstand the Buddhist teaching as one of extinction. That's a word in the old Buddhist texts, striving for extinction. Nirvana is sometimes translated as extinction. This is a one-sided emphasis on the emptiness out of which all phenomena arise. It's too often can become an escape from the world. This denial, this negation of things, it's part of it. That fundamentally, things are no things. There is no substance to this world of phenomena. They just give the appearance of thingness, but in truth, there's nothing there. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. But is that any different from this? This. Wallace Stevens, wonderful poet with a very Zen quality to his poetry, said, "After the final no, there comes a yes. On that yes, the future of our world depends." This can be read as coming out of despair, out of despair into hope and into action. And it is that too. But even more, it's more fundamental than that. It's out of emptiness coming everything. It's really very much the experience of coming out of Sesshin. Finding not just the world, but a new world. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.